This is Cynthia McKinney, and you're listening to Cynthia's Midnight Oil.
The assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is filled with optical illusions. Don't trust your eyes.
Don't trust your eyes.
The truth is in disguise, creating confusion. It's like a theater play on stage. We watch a tale unfold, yet we don't see behind the scenes. The directors and their roles, they're in control. But don't trip, check the script. For behind the scene, the FBI is involved. It will take some time before this mystery is solved. To the naked eye, it's difficult to see their plan. James Earl Ray, or so they say, was a trigger man. He proclaimed innocent and didn't want to take the fall. His first lawyer would fight to end it all. There was overwhelming evidence and many co-conspirators that proved that things were certainly mischievous, like the reassignment of police. But in reality, they didn't want them all up in the vicinity. They didn't want error in the plot they directed. Complications of government agencies suspected. Remember Arthur Hayes, the first lawyer? He was confident. He knew that he would win and Ray would be innocent. But a new lawyer rolled up in the scene. He promised he can help him if he pleads guilty. He offered him cash that James Earl Ray could hire a new lawyer to overturn it if he desired. But Foreman was a liar and conspired to bring Ray to position himself assassin.
We've gotta fight for justice.
For justice.
We've gotta unite for justice.
Oh.
We've gotta believe in justice. We've gotta fight for what's right.
Right. Who really killed Dr. Martin? Dr. Martin Luther King, who did it? Admit it. Find the real killers. Come on, are you with it? Who really killed Dr. Martin Luther King? Who really killed Dr. Martin Luther King? Who did it? Admit it. Find the real killers. Come on, are you with it?
That guilty plea was like a confession to the media. Took a whole week for Ray to figure he was cheated. Attempted to get Haynes back on the case, but unfortunately, it was just too late. And this is how the world was deceived into believing that James Earl Ray killed Dr. King. In fact, there was also destruction of evidence. It was obscene. They tampered with the crime scene. The shooter in the window where the bullet rang out of. The FBI admitted no trace of gunpowder. Furthermore, the test of the bullets, they concluded, didn't match the murder weapon that was used in the assassination. The gross dissemination of relevant information of a leader to a nation that changed a generation. Generation. Ration.
We've gotta fight for justice.
For justice.
We've gotta unite for justice.
Oh.
We've gotta believe in justice. We've gotta fight
for what's right.
For what's right.
Oh. Yeah. Dr. King's legacy will not disintegrate. The civil rights movement cannot evaporate. We must unite to elevate, continuously educate. We got to stop the hate, the dream that Martin Luther King instilled has yet to truly be fulfilled. We can lift every voice and sing, but we gotta make sure that justice rings.
Who really killed Dr. Martin Luther King? Who really killed Dr. Martin Luther King?
Who did it? Admit it. Find the real killers. Come on, are you with it?
Who really killed Dr. Martin Luther King? Who really killed Dr. Martin Luther King?
Who did it? Admit it. The real killers, come on, are you with it?
We've gotta fight for justice.
We gotta fight.
We gotta unite for justice.
For justice.
We gotta believe in justice.
We've gotta fight,
for what's right.
For what's right.
We've gotta fight for justice.
For justice.
We've gotta unite for justice.
Oh my gosh, what a 2 weeks it's been. First, it was my birthday, March 17th, and I just wanted to take a little time off, so I took that week off. It takes me about 12 hours to put each Midnight Oil show together, and that's a lot of time. So I decided to treat myself by taking a week off. Then, unexpectedly, I received a message from my great friend, Marzia Hashemi of Press TV, that she might want to do a documentary to which she might like me to be a contributor. That was a shot that came completely out of the blue. So, of course, I was extremely happy. And so I told Marzia, come on down. So she came and visited me for another week. And so I ended up taking another week off because I literally had no time while she was visiting me. So 1 week became 2 weeks, and, you know, that's the way it goes. But I've missed you all, and now I'm happy to say I'm back. Now, the powers that be might not be so happy to hear me say that, but what the heck. Okay, so today is a very special day. Not just because Midnight Oil is back after a 2 week hiatus, but I think we're back with a bang, a super treat for you guys. Of course, today marks the 49th anniversary of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. 49 years of sadness, 49 years of impunity, 49 years of investigation as to who his real killers were, and who were the conspirators who convinced others to pull the trigger. Who were the conspirators outside of the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, that was the organization headed by Dr. King? And who were the conspirators inside the SCLC? As you all know, I am a student of U.S. targeted assassination policy. And from all that I've studied, there is a playbook. And why deviate from the playbook when it works every time? Thus, we know that there were folks on the inside who helped the United States government to kill Dr. King. The song you just heard was from a singer by the name of Rosalie Placid from Boston. I tried to find her because I wanted to interview her. I wanted to know how she could put so many facts together in such a melodic way and produce this true work of art. But her plea is for justice. And quite frankly, we haven't had justice. Imagine this, folks. The killers of Dr. King, who haven't died a natural death, are still walking around free as a bird. And those who did die a natural death died without ever suffering one day of consequence for committing a murder. They lived free while a movement was killed. Perhaps the members of the U.S. military who were stationed in Memphis on that fateful evening were racist and wanted Dr. King dead for daring to think that Black people could vote and call the shots in a democratic United States of America. After all, we do know that over 30% of the respondents in a poll taken after his murder felt that Dr. King, and this is a quote from the poll, deserved what he got. You've seen that same attitude displayed when an unarmed Black is gunned down by the police, with some folk rushing to tarnish the victim by pointing to his or her problematic lifestyle. Even if that lifestyle had nothing to do with the facts of the victim's murder, just like clockwork, all the sordid details of life as a target in the underbelly of the U.S. apartheid state are trotted out and put on full parade in all national media outlets as to somehow justify the subhuman treatment of victims that also deserved what they got. Yesterday, it was blacks, mostly men, lynched in one way or another and then castrated to prove the point. Today, it's blacks plus Native and Indigenous First Nation Americans, the so-called other people of the Americas who preceded the colonials, plus Muslims in their home countries who have to be lynched by drone and castrated one way or another so they can stop breeding in their traditional families, reproducing more little threats. Threats to whose security? George Zimmerman, the murderer of 17-year-old unarmed Trayvon Martin, netted $300,000 for his legal team from crowdfunding. Then, down on his luck, he auctioned off the gun he used to kill Trayvon and netted almost the same amount again. Clearly, black skin is a weapon so frightening that anyone with it, especially males, has to be seen as a threat to that group of folks that used to control the U.S. and now can only hope to wear a police uniform in order to relive their past days of glory. They have become the warlords appointed by America's new rulers to preserve the new peace. Just like United Nations peacekeepers serve to keep the peace. But whose peace? So that the locals won't rebel against such an unjust system that oppresses them. So we aren't confused by the "oh, today we've made so much progress" line. Fact is, the migrants from formerly colonized Africa and Asia on those transport ships, from the photos that I've seen, look an awful lot like the Africans of the transatlantic slave trade era. What a cargo being hauled in the underbelly of those magnificent ships. Hey, a thought. Who owns those migrant transportation ships anyway? Someone told me that the NGO fleet that's transporting those African and Asian migrants into Europe are financed by George Soros. And of course, that serves the interests of George Soros and whoever he's acting for, not the interests of the poor migrants whose homes have been made unlivable because of U.S. foreign policy, with not one ray of daylight coming between any of the Five Eyes, acting jointly with Europe against the rest of the world. So tonight, we're going to look at the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., what it meant yesterday, and what it means today. Our show is going to be a little different tonight because the music tonight is so significant. I'm going to play the full songs so you can experience the lyrics of these wonderful lyricists. And as usual, here at Cynthia's Midnight Oil, you can count on me to tell you the truth, to call it as I see it, even when it goes against the grain, but especially when it goes against the grain. And so by now, you should know that I will go where even the highest paid corporate special interest, prostitute, fake news, shill media personalities won't even dare to think to tread. That's why I want you to consider this show as your liberated zone, where the shackles on your mind are the first to go. You might get shocked, maybe even outraged, but my hope is that you will not think about things in the same way, that you will have a disorienting dilemma that will cause you to completely rethink what you thought was conventional and what you consider to be wisdom. Remember, the great South African anti-apartheid leader Steve Biko said that the greatest
murder
weapon
murderer,
in the
but you
hands
can't
of
murder
the
murder
oppressor
violence. You can murder a hater, but you can't murder hate.
Oppressed.
And what we are trying to get rid of is hate and injustice and all of these other things that continue the long night of man's inhumanity to man.
This is Cynthia McKinney, and you're listening to Cynthia's Midnight Oil.
I have a dream.
You can take away my freedom. But my spirit will run free.
Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech.
You can take away my vision, that don't mean that I can't see.
Well, I think this is a very significant victory.
Well, all I have to say is it doesn't work that way. What lives inside of me will find its way to be. It all starts with a dream, the dawn of a new day. The God inside of you will always see you through. So hold on to your dream.
I have a dream. I just want to do God's will.
You can try to shake my reason.
And I've seen the promised land.
But you'll never take me down.
I may not get there with you.
You can fill me full of bullets. But I'm built on solid ground. So all I have to say is I'm not going away. It's much bigger than me. God's will will always be. It all starts with a dream. The dark.
Nothing can be accomplished by violence.
Inside my veins. That's all that I will say. The dream won't go away. You can't steal from me what God gave me for free. It all starts with a dream. Inside of you will always see you through. So hold on to your dream. No one can take the dream from your heart. From your heart.
But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
so-called children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
I have to admit that it still brings a tear to my eye. Lenny Kravitz's song just reminded me of all the hopes and transformation that I personally witnessed as a result of the civil rights movement in the United States. I know I talked about the poll taken after Dr. King's death, where a full 30% of the respondents thought that Dr. King deserved what he got. And I'm disappointed in that. You can't believe how disappointed I am. But on the other hand, 70% of the respondents didn't think that. And that's what gives me hope to know that we could have done so much more with our lives and our country had that 70% just acted. In a way, you could say my own activism is to compensate for what others refused at that time of great change in our country to do. I know change is possible, positive change, but we can't just want it. We have to act on our wants. And on an individual level, I've seen personal transformations of Southerners who went through that time in our country and said, I'm not having any more hate. I've personally seen that. I've talked to them, I've touched them, and I have been touched by them. So I do believe in the goodness of people, even when they're coming out of a very bad place. The fact is that they're still moving out of it when they dare to move at all. It was an extraordinary time in the U.S. Young people were refusing to fight the wars against Asians that their own families were cheering. And it is to this hope that I dedicate this show tonight. Please find your hope and then act on it. If you don't act on your own hopes and dreams, I ask you, who will? Tonight's show is not just about the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and what he and his family meant to me. Tonight's show is about what one person can do when they're motivated. Yes, Dr. King was motivated far beyond himself. He wanted the United States to be better for Americans. He wanted the United States to be better for Asians and for Africans, and he wanted us all to be better for the sake of the world. And so tonight's show is not only dedicated to the incredible life that was Dr. King's and the incredible way that that life was snuffed out like a snuff film. The military intelligence operation was called Operation Lantern Spike. And I say, the purpose of that U.S. military intelligence operation was to spike the lantern that was the illumination that Dr. King was providing on how the U.S. government really was acting, behaving as the world's merchant of death. My guest tonight is someone who has carried on Dr. King's work and Dr. King's dream long beyond Dr. King's life and death. Tonight, you will hear him doing his work in a courtroom summation that few have bothered to listen to, even fewer even know exists. I'm talking about Dr. William Pepper, the King family lawyer who has just written a book that tells it all, everything, including the names of those who betrayed Dr. King, those in his inner circle who made the work of the U.S. government easier because they collaborated with the government in the murder of this man. And for 49 years, it's been 49 years today since Dr. King was murdered. There has been no justice. No justice for Coretta King, who went to her grave without her husband. 49 years of no justice for the King children, who grew up without their father. 49 years of no justice for the people of the U.S. who champion law and order in this country and rule of law. And 49 years of no justice for those of us whose lives were struck by the incredible work of this man and the team around him. The millions who were inspired and the tens of millions around the world whose own struggles for freedom were marked by the song, "We Shall Overcome Someday." In December 1999, a jury in Memphis, Tennessee, found the U.S. government complicit and guilty in the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Here is lawyer William Pepper summing up after 30 days of a trial whose outcome he didn't know at that time. But as the trial progressed and culminated in this high point of the summation of the evidence at that time before the jury, there was only one man from the news media in the room. Mark Peruskia of the Memphis newspaper, The Commercial Appeal. The same man who would later uncover that one of the betrayers of Dr. King was none other than Ernest Withers, the famous civil rights photographer, living a double life as an FBI informant from 1958 to 1976. Now, you will hear the first few minutes of William Pepper's summation before the jury, before he goes on to talk about the complicity of the media. Journalists who normally would even have been considered progressive for the day, but who on national security cases always went along with whatever it was that the government had to say, right or wrong. We're experiencing that same problem from today, as fake news has proliferated to populate all of the corporate media outlets. It's hard to find news from them that isn't fake and tainted by government payoffs or even outright ownership. Look at the Washington Post. It officially now is a government outlet. Along with the New York Times, the St. Louis Times Dispatch, the Atlanta Constitution, and more newspapers that I found, that you can find in the COINTELPRO papers that say that the CIA searched out and embedded friendly journalists in them that would unquestioningly write pro-government or government-authorized stories. Since the publication of those COINTELPRO papers, we've learned that outfits like CNN actually have CIA operatives as popular personalities delivering the news. CNN even had a CIA psychological operations team inside its newsroom. But tonight, I want you to hear less of me and more of William Pepper. And after listening to this excerpt of his 1999 closing arguments to the jury, you will hear none other than the real Dr. Pepper. William Pepper, who will talk to us about his new book entitled The Plot to Kill King. Here's William Pepper in 1999 in Memphis, Tennessee, the city in which Dr. King's life had been taken, speaking to the jury and quite obviously also to posterity. This is Cynthia McKinney, and you're listening to Cynthia's Midnight Oil. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please consider making a contribution at the radio station you're listening to or at allthingscynthiamckinney.com.
Martin King, as you know, for many years was a Baptist preacher in the southern part of this country, and he was thrust into leadership of the civil rights movement at a historic moment in the civil rights movement and social change movement in this part of the country. That's where he has been locked in time, locked in a media image, locked as an icon in the brains of the people of this country. But Martin King had moved well beyond that. When he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, he became in the mid-60s an international figure, a person of serious stature whose voice, whose opinions on other issues than just the plight of black people in the South became very significant worldwide. He commanded worldwide attention as few had before him. As a successor, if you will, to Mohandas Gandhi in terms of the movement for social change through civil disobedience. So that's where he was moving. Then in 1967, April 4, 1967, 1 year to the day before he was killed, he delivered the momentous speech at Riverside Church in New York where he opposed the war. Now, he thought carefully about this war. He had been inclined to oppose it for quite a long period of time prior to that, 2-3 years prior to that, he had uneasy feelings. And I remember vividly, I was a journalist in Vietnam when I came back. He had asked to meet with me, and when I opened my files to him, which were devastating in terms of the effect on the civilian population of that country, he unashamedly wept. And I knew at that point, really, that the die was cast. This was in February of 1967. He was definitely going to oppose that war with every strength, every fiber in his body. And he did so. He opposed it, and from the date of the Riverside speech to the day he was killed, he never wavered in that opposition. Now, what does that mean? Is he an enemy of the state? The state regarded him as an enemy because he opposed it. But what does it really mean, his opposition? I put it to you that his opposition to that war had little to do with ideology, with capitalism or democracy. It had to do with money. It had to do with huge amounts of money that war was generating to large multinational corporations that were based in the United States. When Martin King opposed the war, when he rallied people to oppose the war, he was threatening the bottom lines of some of the largest defense contractors in this country. This was about money. When he threatened to bring that war to a close through massive popular opposition, he was threatening the bottom lines of some of the largest construction companies, one of which was in the state of Texas. It was that patronized the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, and it had the major construction contracts at Cameron Bay in Vietnam. This is what Martin King was challenging. He was challenging the weapons industry, the hardware, the armaments industries, that all would lose as a result of the end of the war. Forget about democracy. Forget about any ideology. This opposition to Martin King, this growing enmity to him, was based on money, on the loss of money. The second aspect of his work that also dealt with money, that caused a great deal of consternation in the in the circles of power in this land had to do with his commitment to take a massive group of people to Washington and there to encamp them in the shadow of the Washington Memorial for as long as it took. For as long as it took, they would make daily trips to the halls of Congress, and they would try to compel the Congress to act as they had previously acted in terms of civil rights legislation, now to act in terms of social legislation. Now to begin to talk about a redistribution of wealth in this, the wealthiest country in the world, that had such a large group of poor people, of people living then and now, however, in poverty. That problem had to be addressed. And it wasn't a black and white problem. This was a problem that dealt with Hispanics, and it dealt with poor whites as well. That's what he was taking on, and that's what he was challenging. And the powers in this land believed he would not be successful. Why did they believe that? They believed that because they knew that the decision-making processes in the United States had by that point in time, and today it's much worse in my view, but by that point in time, had so consolidated power that they were the representatives, the foot soldiers of the economic, the very economic interests who are going to suffer as a result of these types of changes. So the very powerful lobbying forces that had put their people in the halls of Congress and indeed in the White House itself and controlled them, paid and bought them and controlled them, were certainly not going to agree to the type of social legislation that Martin King and his mass of humanity were going to require. So there was a fear. What happens when they're frustrated? What happens when they don't get any satisfaction? What would happen, they feared, the military feared, was that there would be a violent rebellion in the nation's capital. And they didn't have the troops that could contain 500,000 angry, poor, alienated Americans. They didn't have the troops. Westmoreland wanted another 200,000 in Vietnam. They didn't have them to give to him. They didn't have them. They were afraid that mob would overrun the Capitol. They were afraid that what Mr. Jefferson had urged many, many times, that the body politic can only be cleansed by a revolution every 20 years. They were afraid that Mr. Jefferson would be listened to and that that revolution would take place. Because of that, those factors, Martin King was not going to be allowed. Not going to be allowed to bring that group of people to Washington. So, that's the reason for the hostility. He saw Memphis as part and parcel of the overall problem, as a microcosm. He saw the plight of the garbage workers here as being symptomatic of the pervasive sickness of American society. So he said, if we turn our backs on these ones, how can we go on behalf of the broad national interest? These ones need us now. Let's start the Poor People's Campaign here, which is what he did. Now, we move to the local conspiracy related to the death of Martin Luther King. You've heard of it. A very reputable 40-year business store owner sit up there and tell you that he always bought every Thursday. He went to Virgil's warehouse. That was his last stop before he went back to Somerville. And on that Thursday, April 4, he heard the owner of that place take the telephone and scream into it, shoot the son of a bitch when he comes on the balcony, and then amongst other things. That's the first indication of the involvement of a Mr. Frank Liberto, which information was given to the police and the FBI and forgotten about. Then you've heard two other independent witnesses testify at different ends of the trial. One called as a witness by the defense, Mrs. LaVeya Addison, who had this conversation with Mr. Liberto in her cafe Well, Liberto leaned over the table at the time when the select committee hearings were on. Apparently, something came on the television and whispered to Mrs. Addison, "I arranged to have Martin Luther King killed." She jumped back and was shocked. So Liberto puts himself in it, against his own interest, mind you. He said that. He's entitled to believe that. Then comes Mrs. LaVeda Addison's son, Whitlock Addison's son, Nathan, who confronts Liberto, and Liberto again confirms the same thing to him. So we see now Mr. Frank Liberto's involvement in this whole scenario. Then we have from the defendant himself in sessions that are before you, and you've heard testimony from Ambassador Young and Mr. King about how he was approached. And he was asked to assist or become involved in this assassination, again by Mr. Liberto. And how he was told that he would be visited by a man called Raul. He would first receive some money, be visited by a man called Raul. He would pass the money to Raul. He would receive a gun. That he was being asked to participate in this endeavor, and he should not worry because there would be no police around. The police would not be there. We've heard him say that, in fact, he did these things and that he received the gun after the shooting. He said he received the gun right at his back door. That's as far as he went in his admissions. And he also, of course, said he didn't know what was going on. Neither Ambassador Young or Mr. King believed him in that respect. He didn't know what was going on. Now, why would anyone say this? Is this something new? No. You heard testimony from witnesses who indicated that Mr. Jowers had said this to them years ago, much as 20 years ago. He had said this. He had said that he knew how Martin Luther King was killed. He had indicated to them that he didn't do it, but he knew how it was done, and in one case actually told the same story way back then that he's telling now. So this is not some afterthought for Mr. Jowers to try to make a movie or become have notoriety or something like that. This is a consistent story that has been around for a long time, and other witnesses from previous times have confirmed it. So, other indications of the local conspiracy. Well, what are they? You've heard about the removal of Detective Reddick, who was a police officer on surveillance duty on the afternoon. He was removed within an hour of the killing, told there was a threat on his life, and he was sent home to arrive at his home at the time of the assassination. Never to hear about this threat again. This was a phony threat. I think it became quite clear. They didn't trust him because he was a community relations officer, had been seconded into intelligence, and when it came to the last minute, they had to pull him off because he might have seen something, done something. It was untrustworthy. So Reddick was pulled off.
So there you have it. There were several layers of conspiracy. At the organizational level, someone or some ones inside the SCLC helping the government. At the local level, some ones inside Memphis helping the government. That ranged from local citizens, including even local medical personnel, to the police department, to the fire department, and so on. Then there was the national U.S. government level that arranged for military photographers to be in place at the time. Military intelligence, special operations soldiers on call and ready at the gun trigger. And finally, he discusses the cover-up, which occurs at the national media level. That's the part of the summation that you didn't hear. It is in this part of the final summation that Pepper describes the effect of, at that time, 30 years of media lies and the effect it has on the mentality of even those who wrote the lies for national and international consumption. And then, of course, on those who read those lies. Finally, Pepper appeals to the jury that their decision will live in history because only they have heard the evidence that no other people in the U.S. had heard. Pepper reminded the jurors that Ray never got the trial that he wanted. Judge Joe Brown was removed before he could grant Ray a trial. Pepper tells the jury that governmental agencies caused this assassination to happen, and they then proceeded to use their immense power to cover up the injustice that they had perpetrated. He called the MLK murder a case of a failure of U.S. democracy. And therefore, he asked the jury to send a message to let justice prevail, to send a message to all those in power that you cannot get away with this, that ultimately truth crushed to the earth will rise again and has risen again in this courtroom. You represent the people of this land, and you must speak for them. That's what William Pepper told the jury. He said, I have confidence in the jury. I have confidence in you. I told William Pepper, you won that case. Your appeal to the jury is amazing. But it's been 49 years. And those conspirators that you discussed in your closing argument have still not been brought to justice. Despite an incredible finding from the jury said, yes, there was a conspiracy to kill Dr. King. And yes, the U.S. government was a part of that conspiracy. So I asked William Pepper, how does it make you feel? And what can we do about it? And this is what William Pepper told me.
Well, of course, I think the greatest sadness that I have is that the people of the United States and indeed the people of the world do not know the truth about how Martin was killed. And they have those facts that have been uncovered and that are part of the new book, The Plot to Kill King, in great detail, I might add, have been suppressed, and they continue to be suppressed. I think the family received a degree of comfort and closure following the trial in 1999. But, you know, that was 18 years ago. And the information that has come to us and the whole story and the truth that was not possible to bring out even then is now known. It is covered in The Plot to Kill King, but the sadness is that it's suppressed in the United States. The corporate media will not reveal or deal with this story, will not even review the book, and they continue to deny the truth about how this great man was taken from us. Well, and they do that, in my view, Cynthia, because there is this great desire to protect governmental agencies and the credibility of government itself when it gets involved in these political assassinations. It's not unique to America. This has happened throughout history where inconvenient leaders are assassinated and put out of action, and then the truth about the ruling forces organizing that and how they organize that
is suppressed. So, you know, people don't quite understand, well, why would they do that? They say that the main characters are dead, but we're not. But the main character individuals are dead, but the main character of agencies, governmental agencies, who serve the interests of the ruling class are alive and well, and they have annual budgets. And if the people knew what they did, not only with respect to the assassination of Martin King, but around the world, they would have lost all credibility many, many years ago. And that's what we have to try to overcome. And we may be able to do it better, Cynthia, by having the truth revealed in areas of the world, say like where you are now, or even in Europe, where they don't have the same control and desire to suppress truth in a case like this. So that's my status. And how do we overcome that? Well, you know, we can push as much as possible and try to get the word out. But the corporate media is very closely controlled now in the United States, much more than it was ever before. And frankly, you have a progressive media that is equally controlled, but much more subtly, through things like foundation grants and that sort of inducement. So even the progressive media, for the very most part, are not willing to allow this story to be told. And it's a national scandal, and it's a loss internationally in terms of any understanding of how the ruling forces in America continue to operate. Well, I think the children are trying to get on with their lives and survive as best they can. It's a difficult situation for them because, of course, Coretta died as well, not that long ago. I think Bernice, who never really knew her father, you know, she was only three at the time. And she learned about him from reading newspaper reports and television documentaries and things of that sort. But so she's very bright, and she's very involved in the struggle to have the truth out wherever possible. I think Marty and Dexter are just going about their business. The values of the father, one would hope, have found a home in all of the children, but we can't expect too much from them, I'm afraid. Another tragedy is the fact that people who were close to Martin King betrayed him, and I go into some detail in the book with a lot of evidence. It's quite a long book, Cynthia, because what I insisted on doing was putting in all of the depositions, all of the evidence, all of the transcripts of testimony, so that when people read the allegations and the narrative of the book, the actual witness statements and evidence is there in the book itself, so they can go and see it, and I cannot be accused of cherry picking information and distorting, because it's all laid out very clearly. And it's a very sad story because of the betrayal of people who were close to Martin King, and we never knew about that until now. You know, I've been involved in this for well, about 40 years. It's 49 since Martin was gone, but I only got involved around 77, 78 for the first time. And next year, as you know, is the 50th anniversary It's a half century since we lost him. So next year is a critical time, and they'll be releasing the paperback, and there will be a number of documentaries coming out, and possibly a feature film. Although there are a lot of pressures to suppress all of the story. I know that documentaries will be done. Will they be widely seen? One would hope so. It's the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin King, so one would hope they would be seen all over the world. And the documentaries and the documentarians have asked me to consult to them to ensure that they are able to tell the truth, and that the every aspect of the documentaries will be truthful. I think that's a good sign for the year coming up, you know. So I think that's useful. It's been a harrowing experience. I had lunch with the shooter of Martin King some months ago. He refused to eat, but he came and sat down and had lunch. And what he doesn't know, and what most people in the world do not know, was that he didn't kill Dr. King. That Martin King was wounded and might well have died, but nevertheless he was taken to the hospital, and he was killed in the emergency room of the hospital. He was killed by the head of neurosurgery at the hospital, and who put a pillow over his face and suffocated him whilst he was still alive, with two men in suits standing on the side. And I describe that in detail from an eyewitness report of a surgical nurse who was ordered out of the room just before Martin King was actually killed. They were determined never to let him leave Memphis because he was going to bring, as you know, 500,000 people or more to Washington to attempt to realign the funding of the government that had been putting so much money into the war, to try to redirect some of those funds into social programs that had been cut.
Dr. Pepper has agreed to participate in an online discussion where you, the inquiring minds of the public, can ask him any question that comes to your mind about any aspect of this very troubling injustice. And like on a Reddit, he will answer any questions he chooses. So I want you to go to my website, allthingscynthiamckinney.com, and sign up now. You will receive instructions on how to join the real Dr. Pepper throughout the weekend answering your selected questions. And with that, gosh darn it, we're out of time. I hope to see you in the chat room at All Things Cynthia McKinney. And for your next Midnight Oil, I'll see you next week. This is Cynthia McKinney, and you've been listening to Cynthia's Midnight Oil. If you like this show, please show your love by donating at the station you're listening to or at allthingscynthiamckinney.com.
William Pepper was a young man when he first met Dr. King, who read his war reporting on Viet children's suffering. Martin asked young William Pepper to speak about the war, to come to his congregation, and they were friends forevermore. Then William went to law school to put his talents to the task, to fight for social justice, to answer questions we must ask. It was April 4, 1968, when Martin Luther King was murdered in the broad daylight. It was a devastating thing. There was a mighty rush to judgment, to blame it on James Earl Ray. There was agreement in the government to tell the media what to say. The media called it a crime of hate, a lone nut simple thing. Now we know it was an act of state, the execution of Dr. King. James Earl Ray was just a patsy, an escaped prisoner for sure, with a top security identity for the whole 9 months before. Some rogues within the government shielded James as Eric Alt, gave him a car and a driver's license to secure him till the assault. To protect this petty criminal, to put the patsy into place, his handlers sent him to Memphis, where like a pawn he showed his face. Well, Martin marched for civil rights, and he stood against all war. He spoke for truth and justice and nonviolence for sure. When Martin stood with the workers in solidarity with the poor, that high-class oligarchy hated Martin, that's for sure. Earl Clark was one of the Memphis cops meeting at Lloyd Jowers Grill, across from the Lorraine Motel where Dr. King was killed. Two military sniper teams would have also fired if the police team from Memphis failed to do what was required. Next day, cops cleaned the crime scene, all the brush and the proof away. They avoided all the witnesses that might have some truth to say. Too many unanswered questions still blowing in the wind, in a murder investigation so deliberately ruined. Too many disturbing answers still came out in the trial, enough to prove conspiracy to a nation in denial. Six white, six black jurors unanimously agreed the facts presented at the trial proved who really did the deed. Yes, it all came out in the trial that in 99 they won, when the government was convicted of the conspiracy they'd done. Pepper was a lawyer who won the case in court, but when he went to the press conference, no reporters came to report. So here's to William Pepper, the King family, brave and wise, for standing for the truth for us, for overcoming all the lies. William Pepper, keep on struggling, you know you'll follow teachings and the vision and the dream of Dr. King. William Pepper wrote a book about the trial and everything, an act of state, the execution of Martin Luther King, an act of state, the execution of Martin Luther King.